You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and once again this week, we're checking in with all the beat writers from the AL Central teams. We can stop with the prognosticating and guessing and start talking about real things happening in real games, so that's always fun. 2015 season is underway. Got off to a good start for the Tigers with a win over the Twins and an outstanding performance from David Price. Jason Beck was there, and Jason Beck is here with us, as usual. Beck, Price is obviously a big key to this club. You lose Max Scherzer from the rotation. You don't know where or what Justin Verlander is going to be at this stage of his career. So how encouraging was it? It's only one game, but 8 2/3 innings on opening day and a few called third strikes, not just strikeouts, but called third strikes. You really had the Twins locked up, it looked like.
Yeah, he looked like he was, really on target there. It was kind of a continuation of spring training where he got through the first trip through the order unscathed. The big difference was he didn't find a whole lot of trouble the second and third trips, whereas that had really been his problem the last few starts in the spring. Talking with pitching coach Jeff Jones, they worked with him on kind of improving his delivery out of the stretch. He was getting a little bit too quick. I don't know if that was a base runner thing or what, but from what Jeff Jones was saying, they tried to make his stretch more like his more like his wind up type delivery, which there really isn't a whole lot of difference to begin with for him, but they really tried to make it even more similar. And I think what you saw was he didn't get out of sync when he had, when he finally gave up a base runner, and that kind of prevented, the first hit from fourth hits, which is kind of what happened there near the end of the spring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, speaking of the spring, it was a talking point throughout camp was, whether or not they'd come to some kind of agreement on a contract extension. I don't think anybody ever viewed it as entirely realistic to get that done before spring training with a pitcher of Price's caliber and knowing what he can command on the open market. But, Beck, you look around, and now Rick Porcello got $82.5 million from the Red Sox. It's just the price of pitching in free agency is just astronomical. How do you see this situation playing out? I mean, it's pretty obvious Price is going to test his market. Do you think just what's your gut tell you as far as a long-term fit here? You think it's something the Tigers can do?
I mean, I guess it goes without saying. I mean, he's got all the momentum here. It would seem like just as long as he keeps going like this and he doesn't have any major injury history in his career, I think the impression I've gotten from checking around is that, to pardon the pun, David Price has a price in mind. And, if the Tigers want to get up around that area, they're certainly welcome to do so. And he would listen and, might even sign. But, short of that, I don't think there's too much really to talk about. And that's kind of, I think, what you would expect. He's not in a situation where there's really that huge, massive history with him in Detroit to where there's this huge momentum for him to sign long-term. He's definitely a creature of comfort, but, I think that only goes so far. He's already endured one mid-season trade, so, he's kind of handled this change of scenery rather well. And I think there's a lot of reason for him, especially if this pitching market gets a little less crowded. You could see a lot of motivation for him to hit the open market and see what's out there, to at least explore it and only sign if it's something that he really wants to do and if it's the type of deal that really appeals to him. And right now, I just, you don't get the sense that there's a whole lot of momentum trending towards that.
Yeah, and you got to give Porcello a lot of credit. Parlayed a breakout season into a $82 million guarantee with his new club, and for all we know, he could have done even more on the open market if he had another big year. So good for him. All right, shifting gears now, Beck. I mean, opening day, you get caught up in the result. Everybody does, but you also you look for little things that are real, you know, are sustainable. And Alex Avila might have had the best, most encouraging outcome of the day with that opposite field home run. Obviously, that's something he's working on, using the whole field more. And not that you don't expect greatness from David Price this season, but I thought the Alex Avila home run was maybe even a better sign for the Tigers moving forward.
Yeah, and I wrote a little bit something about that today, where it's something that he had quietly been working on for a large part of the spring. And really near the end there, near the final days, you saw some results out of it. I mean, it's incredible to think that was his first home run in the left field since September 15th of 2013, I believe. He didn't have any home run to left, center, and right. And that's for somebody who, you know, and he says that when he came up, his power was more to the gaps, including left center field, than it was as like a true pull hitter. And somehow he got away from that. He's trying to get back to it, not just for the home runs, but just for the overall hitting.
Yeah.
Because the more that opponents have shifted him, he's really struggled to counter that. I looked it up. I think he ranked 23rd on the most shifted players in the majors last year. And the gap between what he did on line drives and grounders, again, you know, when shifted as opposed to when he wasn't shifted, was massive. I think it was like 177 average against a shift and then 325 otherwise. And it was like the second largest gap among the top 25 players. I think Carlos Santana was the other guy. I mean, that's incredible to think, and it's something for as discerning of a hitter as Alex can be when he's on. It's something you would like to think that he can correct if he really puts his mind to it. And I think we're starting to see that. You know, there's a home run. There's another hit to left field later on in the day. He had during one of the final spring training games, he had a nice double off the wall in the left field corner, you know, which really kind of opened my eyes. So you're starting to see the results there, and now he's got to carry it forward. And he's going to have to do it against pitchers and defenses that are going to try to pitch him the pull. So it's going to have to be something he really works at.
Well, Avila showed power on opening day. Miggy Cabrera showed a lot of power in spring camp, which was the question mark going in, coming off the ankle surgery. That obviously, the ankle injury last season limited his power, made Miggy basically more of a doubles guy than a home run guy than he had been in the past. But it certainly looks like he could be back to his old self, which is dangerous for the rest of the AL Central. But back, especially the way he turned it on that last week, is that an especially good sign for the Tigers from a power perspective?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think you're starting to see. I thought the power was going to take longer to reemerge, given the fact that he didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to do lower body workouts this off season. And I thought, you know, the strength in the legs was going to have to be more of a process. And just watching him over the final couple of weeks of the spring, it's hard to recognize any sort of recent injury with him or a recent surgery. It's really incredible to think. And to me, almost as encouraging a sign, although it sounds a little weird, he hit to a double play, but he was busting it down the line and accelerated in a way that he really wasn't able to do last year. It was the type of ground ball where he would have trotted the first base last year, and he sped up trying to force a play and, you know, maybe potentially even try to, that is for him to do these days. But I think even signs like that are really encouraging to see from him, given the type of surgery he had.
The guy, not thinking about surgery here, but just the bicep cramp that cramped his style in spring training, Justin Verlander. Very fluid situation. Even as we're recording this, Beck, we don't know exactly if he'll be back on the prescribed timetable Sunday in Cleveland, or if that might be pushed back. But does the anxiety, I guess, with the situation kind of waver by the day, depending on what's going on with Verlander behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think the longer this lingers, the more reason there is for concern. When this first happened, they were saying that he was expected to make his next spring training start in 5 or 6 days, and that obviously didn't happen. And now we're at a point where, you know, that regular season outing looks more and more tenuous. It's just it's less of a cramp at this point, and I think they're starting to admit that it was at least some extent of a strain, although Verlander will still call it a mild strain, and they say they're concerned. But I think the longer it goes, the longer you have to be at least a little bit worried that even if it's nothing major structurally, that it's something that can affect them or maybe even flare up again. It's a type of thing that if there's any trepidation, you wonder if he's going to be able to recapture that form that he had in those couple of innings before he had the injury. Because that really was his best outing of the spring. That was closest to the old Verlander than I think any of us had seen since, you know, maybe 2000 playoff game in Oakland.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a tease. And certainly it's strange to see Justin Verlander's name on the disabled list. Very strange strange times for the Tigers in that regard, but they had a good time on opening day and looking to take that all the way to their fifth straight central title. So we'll be checking with Beck frequently this season on this podcast. Hot off the heels of opening day, joined by Jeffrey Flanagan. And Jeffrey, besides the win, how about the bling of that American League championship ring the Royals handed out? That thing is a stunner. I guess I haven't paid much attention to pennant winning rings as much as World Series winning rings, but that was up there with the World Series rings you see.
Yeah, I agree. They didn't spare any cost, did they? I think they weren't very fired up about the whole ring ceremony and stuff like that till it actually happened, because it still kind of reminds them, you know, that they lost Game 7, and that's obviously the ultimate goal. But then once it happened yesterday and the pennant was hoisted and the crowd's cheering, they kind of got back into the spirit again.
Yeah, for those who haven't seen the ring, it does have a diamond on it with all the bases. And, you know, fortunately, the Jostens did not put a little blue diamond on third base to represent Alex Gordon.
yeah, that's right.
But in happier topics, the opening day win was obviously a nice start and against a White Sox team that a lot of people are expecting big things from. But, you know, I like to look at what's real in those games. And Mike Moustakas going out to the field, something he had not done in his big league career, and to do it at Kauffman Stadium where it's tough to do.
That's
a pretty nice sign for them.
Yeah, I mean, all the players were talking about that in the clubhouse afterward. Yeah. They were just kind of amazed that that Moose could really go opposite way and hit a home run in a park that big. You know, I was talking to Rios about his home run, and he kind of stopped me in mid-question and goes, well, what about Moose's home run? That was really the impressive one, because, you know, there was a little bit of wind blowing out that way, but not that much to really carry a ball. And he's been working so hard in the spring trying to figure out ways to beat the shift and trying to not just flip the ball the other way, but drive it the other way. And we've seen, you know, flashes of it where he'll get a ball the other way that looks like it was fairly hard driven, but this one he just clobbered and it went out pretty easily, you know, in one of the toughest parts of the ballpark. So that's a really good sign for Moose and a good sign for the Royals.
No, not that I sit at home drawing up Royals lineups. I'm not quite that big of a dork, but I never would have penciled in Moustakas for the number two hole. I don't think many people would have, you know, going to spring training. That kind of became a late spring development, and opening day, there he was, number two in the lineup. What's Ned Yost's rationale behind that?
Well, basically, he's trying to get Moose's confidence up, kind of the way he's done with players in the past. You know, years ago, he stuck with Eske and didn't pinch hit for him during an entire season, which was maddening the Royals fan. But, you know, Ned sees the bigger picture a lot easier than a lot of us do. And his idea with Moose is to get him up in the order early, get him involved offensively early in the game. You know, don't have him sit for an inning or two and start to fret about his at-bats. You know, just get him get him on page right off the bat, and coming off a decent spring, not a great spring, just keep that momentum going. And look, let's be honest, everything Ned touches lately has just turned to gold, and there's probably going to be another one of them, you know, where, you know, it makes some sense. He did this, he's talked about this before, he did this with Alex Gordon a few years back when everybody in baseball had given up on Alex, you know, the fans had, the, you know, even some of the Royals insiders had given up on him too, and then Ned stuck him in the three hole, and he has a career year. So Ned just has some magic about that. I mean, you wouldn't really believe Alcides Escobar is a leadoff guy either with his career on base percentage. I think he's under 300, and Moose is 290, I think. And here's your 1-2 hitters, but you know what? It's just like in the playoffs last year, just like in September, it's working. So you just can't argue with it.
You can't. Ned has shown that golden touch, as you said, and some things he touched last year led to diamonds, as we saw with the ring. And maybe a diamond in the rough, and Alex Rios, a guy they signed for a bounce-back year, hoping for a bounce-back year, had a huge spring, showed a lot of power in spring, showed some power in opening day, as you mentioned earlier. You know, how big can Rios be for this lineup? And, again, we know that's a tough place to hit for power, but we also know Alex Rios can bring the power when he's motivated and healthy and has a swing working for him.
Yeah, it's just huge. I mean, you look at this lineup now, and you can argue that your two weakest spots are 1 and 2 in the lineup. The rest of the guys, there aren't really any holes. You know, they expect Morales to have a big comeback year, and he looked good yesterday. He walked 3 times and got a hit, and Rios had 3 hits and just clobbered a ball too, like he did all spring, and that just brings more pop to this lineup. I've said many times this spring, I think they're going to be a different looking team this year than they were last year. I think they've upgraded at DH, and I think they've upgraded in right field, and you're going to see more offense on this team. I think possibly they might give up more runs, you know, losing James Shields and replacing him with Volquez, but I think this offensive lineup is going to score more, and it's just going to be kind of a different looking team where this won't be the last time I don't think you're going to see them reach double digits in a game. I think they're not going to be the 27 Yankees or anything like that, but they're going to, I think they were at 4.02 in runs scored last year, which was a tick below the league average. I bet they finish above the league average this year in runs scored, and they win more games by maybe just slightly outslugging the other team. Not necessarily at home, but, you know, they're still going to be a doubles and triples team at home and hit the occasional homer. But there's more pop in this lineup. It just looks better when you look at it. And if they get any kind of production out of Moose, the two-hole, and Askew has a decent year leading off, I think they really are going to score more runs.
Well, one of my favorite annual things to track with the Royals is the Steve Balboni watch. And I'm sure it's something we'll visit from time to time in this podcast. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, Jeffrey. This is the 30th anniversary of Steve Balboni clubbing a club record 36 home runs.
Woohoo!
Yeah. Is this the year? I'm not asking you to pick who will do it, but is this the year somebody does it?
Nope, not a chance. Okay. If they get to 30, I would be kind of shocked. I mean, if somebody on this team got to 30. And there's some candidates. I don't think necessarily Rios is a candidate, but I think Morales could be a candidate if he stays healthy all year and has a big bounce back year. We just don't know about Haas. I mean, Haas has, of course, that kind of power too, and he could go off for 30. But, you know, about that record too, it's a little bit tainted because in I think it was 95, Gaetti hit 35 home runs, but that was
right.
A strike short year of 144.
Right. 144,
so he probably would have beat it that year, but it's an amazingly low ceiling for home run record in baseball. Is that the lowest? It probably is. I mean, I can't imagine anybody else having a team record that's 36.
I don't have it in front of me, but I would bet good money that it's the lowest. And yeah, Gaetti could have pushed it to maybe like 38. It could have been much better. But you know, it looked like a less happy note for a minute there. How do you describe the feeling and the mood in the ballpark when Yordano Ventura comes out? It turned out to be a thumb cramp, and the Royals are saying it's no big deal. But, man, watching that was one of the weirder pitching injuries you'll see. And anytime a guy of that stature comes off the mound like that, you hate it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you just heard an entire crowd of 40,000 just gasp, and including the guys on the bench, too, because it was weird. I mean, he made the pitch. It got fouled off. He did his follow-through, and there didn't seem to be anything wrong, and suddenly he just collapsed to the ground and just holding what looked like his right arm at first. We couldn't really tell from the press box view. But then when he started, when the trainer came out, Nick Kenny, and started rubbing his hand, I turned to a couple guys in the press box. I said, that's got to be a cramp. Yeah. Because if you've ever had one in the middle of the night when your foot cramps or your toe cramps, you know how painful it can be. It just like it startles you, like what the heck is going on here? And your dino told me afterward that he's had them before, and especially coming from 95 degree dry heat in Arizona and for 6 weeks, and then coming back to the Midwest where it was really humid yesterday, and it's a totally different climate, and I'm sure that probably triggers some kind of spasm, cramp, and they were all pretty relieved afterward that that's all it was. And he was, I talked to him, shook his hand, and he's fine. He wanted to prove to me that it was all right. So, yeah, I doubt seriously he would even miss a bullpen session. I think he'd be fine for his next start. But, boy, that's scary because he just signed the $23 million guaranteed contract over the weekend. Very happy kid right now. He's going to be able to take care of his family. And then, boom, I mean, the first thing you think of is, there goes TJ, you know. but it wasn't anything like that, so they lucked out there.
Well, that contract, pitcher injuries happen, and pitchers always a risk for an injury, but that's a pretty safe contract, I would say. 5 years, $23 million. Not unlike the Chris Sale or the Chris Archer contracts. Those are the two that just popped in my mind when I saw that. It's a very, it's still a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but it's a pretty good deal for the Royals going forward.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, if you can say that it's a club friendly contract, it really kind of is. Now that you mentioned, there's always a risk with a pitcher that he can go down, but they've got insurance and everything like that. But for $23 million to lock up a kid that has this big a future, is a pretty good deal. And you wipe out, the great thing for the Royals is you wipe out his first 2 years of free agency. So I mean,
right.
If you know, racks up five straight Cy Young years, they're not going to get murdered. I think the club option years are $12 million each. And for a guy like that, by who knows what the economics will be 7 years from now, I mean, that's probably going to be a steal, I would think, down the road.
Yeah, we were just talking on the Tigers podcast with Jason Beck about Rick Porcello getting $82.5 million off of a breakout year. So lock them up young and when they're young and hungry and on the rise. So I want to thank Jeffrey Flanagan for joining us live from Houston, Texas. Is Jordan Bastian, and of course Houston is where the Indians opened up the 2015 season, opened up on a bum note on opening day, but obviously don't read too much into that. JB, Corey Kluber was terrific on opening day, probably not overly surprising there. He's a guy who has pretty good focus. I don't think the opening day jitters get to him, but the big news with Kluber is the extension. Obviously they extended both him and Carlos Carrasco, but let's start with the Cy Young Award winner and how that deal went down. We talked about before that the Indians had a lot of leverage in these negotiations because Kluber is so far removed from free agency. At the same time, there was benefits to the club to get some, long-term projection and know where, what percentage of the payroll he's going to be eating up in future years. So what was your view of that deal? Good deal for both sides, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I think it's a great deal for both sides. And I think, one thing that was interesting from talking to some people just about the structure of the contract, which has a lot of different layers to it, was Kluber kind of came to them and said he almost wanted something that could be like a lifetime contract. And obviously they don't give out lifetime contracts for players, especially pitchers. But what the Indians tried to do, because he's in a unique situation in terms of where he is with his age, is they have now built a deal where it could potentially keep him in a Tribe uniform through his age 35 season, and set him up for, that's not an age usually where you're going to get a big, huge, long deal in free agency.
Right.
So they've set it up nice, and they put in a lot of layers where, to build in for trade scenarios and a lot of escalators where the salary is what it is, but he has the potential to earn even more money by continuing to perform at a high level. So I think it was a great deal in terms of kind of accomplishing cost certainty on the Indians side and also the potential to earn more and stay in a Cleveland Indians uniform for a long time for Kluber's side.
Yeah, it was a creative and well-thought-out deal, and the escalators are great for Kluber, and the base is great for the Indians. So happy to see that worked out for them. Hope everyone's happy with that. The Carlos Carrasco deal is definitely, you know, comes across as much more team-friendly. And Kenny Rosenthal had a piece that explained how that came to be. Really some interesting stuff in there about Carrasco having I don't think you call any heart procedure minor. It wasn't, a stent or something that major, but certainly something that was a scare for him. And you know, him thinking about that moving forward really played a big part in that deal, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I mean, and obviously this wasn't a major issue because at no point did it disrupt his spring training or his off season. He obviously had the procedure, but I mean, he's healthy and ready to go. And obviously, I don't think the Indians would have invested even at a team friendly rate if they thought there was some,
right,
you know, major concern there. So just that's first of all. But second of all, you're right. I mean, I think anybody that has a brush with mortality, can have that heightened sense of the importance of security, especially in his case. He just has a new daughter who just arrived, and he has four kids, and you know, and he really has had a career that, you know, much like Kluber, in the sense of patience has finally paid off, and he kind of is not necessarily a late bloomer, but you know, they kept giving him chances, and he turned it around down the stretch last year, which is good to see, but there's some inherent risk there, and I'm sure he knows that too. That, you know, just like we all know, it was only a 10-start sample. He knows that, and so he's looking at that, from the security of it for his family standpoint. And yeah, maybe it was a lower deal than he could have got, but at the same time, you know, they also again included some escalators, included some options, and you know, tried to, you know, insert things into his contract as well that would benefit him in the long run.
I don't think on August 1st of last year, either one of us would have predicted an extension for Carrasco. That would have seemed not in step with the way he pitched well out of the bullpen, don't get me wrong. But, he's come a long way in a short time, and it is a 10-start sample, but they obviously saw some very real things within that. And just that sense of stability they built there. And we talk about it all the time, but it really did start with Francona coming over here, and he himself has been extended since then. But it's talking about coming a long way in a short time for an organization to be where they were in August of 2012 and to be where they are now. It's just a complete 180 in terms of that feeling of stability and that feeling that they're building something together.
Yeah, it's been pretty remarkable how quick this thing's turned around. You're right. I think Tito Francona plays a huge role in that. One thing the Indians have to do is they have to hit on these types of deals. They have to hit on those smaller trades because, I mean, we know they're not going to go and win bidding wars in free agency or sign the top international talent that hits the market. So they've got to, you know, find ways to get creative and to invest in the right guys. And I think what they've done here, which is really important, is they know now what these guys are going to earn through their arbitration years. And I think that's very important because if those players go year to year and they do perform like they did down the stretch last year, those arbitration rates can skyrocket. So there's cost certainty in these guys. And if they just go forward as innings eaters, it's still really cost-effective deals. So I think it's a really good situation for the Indians because now as they plan for potential payroll additions in future seasons, they now know a little more specifically how much they already have committed, and that's important.
Hey, JB, now that they have all this cost certainty going forward, can they go out and get that big right-handed bat this week?
That's right, the big right-handed bat that they need. I think Brandon Moss, watching him this spring, I think over time people will realize a big left-handed bat is just as cool.
It is just as cool, man. But, you know, I don't dismiss the left-on-left issue this club has and has had in recent seasons. We saw that opening day when they got Keuchel, Dallas Keuchel. He can probably do that to a lot of clubs, but that's not a small sample of struggles there for them against more especially the top of the line left-handed guys. So, what's your sense of that moving forward? I mean, there's only so much Frank Kona can do from a lineup juggling standpoint, obviously.
Right. I think the one thing that Keuchel's kind of in that upper echelon of left-handed starters. You hate to read too much into that, but what I thought was interesting is when he left,
you saw Tony Sipp come in, former tribesman.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about the timing of it was, so Francona kind of bit the bullet and went with three lefties at the top of his lineup with Bourne, Kipnis, and Brantley, and he put switch hitting Jose Ramirez in the nine hole. And the Astros, after Keuchel had seven shutout innings, saw Ramirez leading off, followed by three lefties. So they brought in the lefty, and he was effective in holding the Indians in check, and that set up the win in the ninth inning for the Astros. So I think that's what you're going to see a lot of this year, is not only, maybe some issues against left-handed starting pitchers, but that there's that piece of the lineup where if it lines up right for an opposing team's bullpen, the Indians are going to see a left-handed pitcher every single time. And I think we've grown accustomed to seeing that over the last few years. I think over the last two or three years combined, only the Mariners have had more plate appearances against left-handed pitchers. So teams are trying to throw lefties at the Indians, and for good reason. I think their OPS was 14th in the American League against lefties last year. So obviously that's not great. It's going to be a challenge all year. And the one thing that Tito had talked about in terms of doing that lineup was the way they're built, they're going to have a run of lefties at some point in that lineup. And he figured if he goes out of the top, feels that those are three of his best hitters, and the idea is to beat the starter, not try and worry about what's going to happen when relievers come into the game.
Yeah.
Honestly, he's kind of backed into a corner, and that probably is the best strategy out of the gates here, but it's definitely going to be something that's going to bear watching over the course of this season. And, you know, who knows, if this team's in it and you get towards the trade deadline, if it continues to be an issue, you know, maybe that's something they got to look to address.
And they go get the big right-handed bat. From a starting standpoint, I was on another show yesterday, and somebody made the point, well, how many elite left-handed starters are there? I go, well, two of the top three left-handed starters in baseball are in this division, so that's not ideal with Chris Sale and David Price, of course. But all right, so last thing, JB, neither you or I think we've both been away enough that we haven't gotten to see those Progressive Field updates, seen some pictures. They look pretty good. But how excited are you just to check that out on the day of the home opener on Friday?
You know what I'm excited about, and this is kind of probably funny, but the kids' clubhouse. Because once a year I try and, when I'm not working, bring my son to the game. And he actually cried when he heard that they were changing the kids' clubhouse. He was very upset because he loved it so much. So I thought it was funny. Shapiro put out a photo on Twitter the other day of Chris Antonetti going down this two-story slide in the kids' clubhouse. And I've been texting pictures to my son or to my wife to show my son some of the things they've been doing there to kind of like reassure him, like, hey, buddy, they're making it better. It's awesome. You know, so I'm excited to get in there and kind of see some of that stuff, and I'm sure other parents kind of feel the same way. And then obviously just that center field section, being able to walk in and kind of have that sweeping view. I know over the winter, even as they were still doing construction, I thought it was pretty impressive when you were walking downtown to kind of see into the ballpark. And it was noticeable, like I said, even when the cranes were there. So I'm sure it'll be pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to it. I think they're doing a lot of the right things, getting a lot of cool concessions stuff in there, getting creative with ticket ideas. They have the one where you can get a beer on the Indians and watch the game from that corner bar. I mean, I think the Indians are trying to provide many ways to convince more people to come. And I think, you got to at least tip your hat, to them in that regard, trying to put a winning product on the field and trying to give things at the ballpark to, entice people to come check it out. So it should be interesting.
Absolutely. Now I think it's our job to convince them to put a couple seats for writers and some outlets in that corner bar. We can so that'd be a pretty good vantage point, I think, and get a grilled cheese from Melt and write your story. I think that could work out pretty well for us. But until that happens, we'll continue to do this little podcast. And this is very special. Scott Merkin joining us on his way to Adam LaRoche's high school, where the complex is being named after Adam LaRoche and his... Wait, explain this again to me, Mark. The complex is named after
LaRosa
in the it's a new field that they've developed there. That's it's for the high schools, which plays close to all the funds for the field, and it's the complex is named after the field is to be named after his uncle Dave, who coached him, and his cousin is the current coach of the baseball team, and that Adam said that's one of his closest friends in the world. So there you go. It's quite an event for him. I talked to him in spring training about it, and he was a little nervous about it being ready, but it sounds like it's ready to go, and I think they're even playing on the high school team playing a game today on the new field.
Well, Adam LaRoche is a great ambassador for MLB, and obviously has been very good to his alma mater, but Merck, I do have to question his parenting skills after everybody saw that video of Bo Jackson having to explain his career to young Drake LaRoche. I guess you can't cover all the bases as a parent, but it was certainly fun to hear Bo Jackson's own Wikipedia page, I guess, voiced by himself.
Yeah, I think in fairness to Drake, he's, 12 or 13, so
yeah.
He seemed to know about the baseball days. He just didn't know about the football days, but that was,
right.
As they say, that went viral pretty quick. That was pretty fun. I'll tell you what, he's a great kid, though. He was with his dad for a good part of spring training, and he's got a locker in the new complex. That, they redid the home locker room at U.S. Cellular, so he'll be there, I imagine, most of the summer. And really fit in well. Just a real respectful, well-mannered, kid who really seems to enjoy baseball and, helps out where he can. So, I guess Adam, that was one of the selling points for him in coming to Chicago, is that he knew Robin from when he did the same thing with his dad, Dave, who everyone remembers is a left-handed pitcher, I think was a brief time as a closer, at least a reliever for the Cubs, and was the bullpen coach for the White Sox when Robin played there. And that's where kind of Adam and Andy formed a bond with Robin when Robin was, a player kind of looking out for the kids back then.
All right, Mark, enough of these rosy, fuzzy topics. Let's get down to the meat of the matter. Let's panic a little bit. Jeff Samardzija gave up 9 home runs in 21 innings in spring training. Follows that up on opening day with a clunker against the Royals, 5 walks, gave up another home run. Is there much concern about Samardzija? What have you seen from him, and what do you sense from them?
Well, based on the reaction I've seen on Twitter and just heard from my family in Chicago, it sounds like baseball became a one-game sudden-death season for the Cubs and White Sox after that opener. But, no, I don't think there's any panic or any trends or anything else you can take from, one game in spring training. And, like you said, he had three walks yesterday. They had, four. They had 5 as a team, 4 scored. And that's something that he has talked about even in spring training when he was giving up the home runs. And as long as he's, doing it with the bases empty, that it's not as big a thing because he's going to challenge hitters. So that seemed to bother him yesterday. And, he hit 2 guys too, which seemed to bother the Royals a little bit. But
yeah.
I think it's not a trend. I mean, it's kind of hard to take anything out of it. We were discussing this yesterday. Paul Konerko always had like a kind of a kill date when you kind of looked at the season and said, okay, now you can tell who's in or who's not. I think it was 100 games. But, yeah, one game certainly was not it. I don't remember exactly what Konerko had on it, but one game's on it. So he'll be fine. And, Chris Sale is supposedly coming back this Sunday to pitch, and that's going to set the rotation up. So, yeah, it was a bad game against a really good team, the defending American League champions, who had a really good pitcher going. So, yeah, I don't think there's any even remote reason to panic unless you just really like panic.
I love to panic, but I'm in the minority. I'm probably in the majority, actually. But so you can kind of shrug off the home runs in Arizona. The ball does not fly as well in Kauffman Stadium, but again, one start, and we'll see how the Shark recovers. He has a lot of incentive to recover, not just for the team, but for himself. So,
sure.
And you mentioned Chris Sale. That thing went about as good as the White Sox could hope. I know April 12th was kind of the target date for a while, and it sounds like that's going to happen.
Yeah, the worst-case scenario, the day it happened became the best-case scenario after it happened. I don't think there were many of us, or maybe even some of the White Sox, who thought the 12th was possible. Just the next day, they needed a number, they needed a full 5-starter complement. It was April 21st. And I think we all kind of looked at that and said, well, he broke a bone in his foot. That makes the best sense that it's going to take a little bit to get back. But to his credit, to Herm Schneider's credit, the White Sox head athletic trainer, they worked hard and they got back, and he's supposedly going to be with the team come Wednesday and ready to go throw a bullpen according to Don Cooper on Friday and be ready to go on Sunday. Now, if there was forecast for rain in the second game of the series against the Royals, so you know, I'm not sure how that would mess with things if it did, but I can't imagine that they would move Chris back to Cleveland, who's hit him pretty well over his career, A, and B, give up a home date. You know, I think Chris is pitching April 12th, assuming there's no minor setbacks between, you know, before April 12th, and then they'll arrange the rotation around it if they need to.
Shifting gears, talk a little about the lineup, Mark. I guess it's the one part of the lineup you look at and feel a little nervous about is the bottom third of the order. So coming off a big spring, how big is Micah Johnson for this club, batting in the nine hole? And we know Robin Ventura wants him to kind of turn that lineup over a little bit with his hit tool and speed tool.
Well, I think one thing Rick Hahn did, one of the many things he did with this offseason, you know, kind of reshaping speed up process was made them more athletic and gave them more, you know, speed options. Last year, Adam Eaton was pretty much it that you could hit number one. Maybe, you know, I think Gordon Beckham hit there once or twice against a lefty. I think Alexi might have been up there once against a lefty. But now you have some options. You have a guy like Eaton. You have a guy like J.B. Shock, and then you have Micah. And Micah, you know, can fly. I mean, just watching him go from first to third or on a single or first to home on a double, you get how much raw speed he has. And then also he's got that ability that, you know, you like to see out of a leadoff guy who he can, you know, extend starting pitchers. That's what the 05 team did so well is, you know, they hit a lot of home runs, but they weren't a great offensive team, but they made, you know, they had the pitching that could make a couple runs hold up, and they could knock those starters out early by, you know, extending at bats, going, you know, taking a four-pitch bet and making it seven or eight, and getting to the middle relief, which is what every team in baseball wants to do. And, you know, Micah showed that yesterday. His first career at bat was a 13-pitch at bat against Jordano Ventura, arguably one of the better young pitchers in the game. And he falls off seven straight fastballs between 95 and 97 miles an hour before he didn't line out the center, but still an excellent bat. So, yeah, him playing well and him kind of finding a rhythm defensively is big for that whole lineup. Because, like you said, it gives you that second leadoff hitter. It gives Eaton a chance for, you know, some RBI opportunities also. But it just kind of balances it out a little bit. I think he could be, you know, everyone talks about Carlos Rodon as, you know, a mid-season Cobb, and people have, you know, the prognosticators have picked him as the American League Rookie of the Year. But I think Micah could be in that race too, because Micah, you know, a dynamic offensive force just has to kind of balance the defense a little bit.
Yeah, you have to like the way he asserted himself this spring. There's this hodgepodge situation at second base, and he just seized it. It was a pretty easy decision for the White Sox in the end.
Carlos Sanchez had a great camp, and he actually broke camp with the team. I would imagine he's going to go to Charlotte when Chris Sale is activated, because they're not going to go with a six-man bullpen. But, yeah, I mean, one thing they have that they haven't had in years, there were two or three years I can remember there where, you know, aside from Gortz, there weren't many middle infield prospects there. And now, you know, you have quite a few. They're real high on Tyler Saladino, who's playing in Charlotte, shortstop. He's a, you know, good utility guy too, and Carlos Sanchez. So that there's some options there now for the team.
As you said, Mark, it can be 100 games before you know much about a team. It could be 162 games before you really know what a team is. But 25 of their first 28 overall are against Central clubs. So I guess we'll have a little bit of an inkling, you know, where the White Sox stand relative to their division peers, at least that first run through.
Yeah, I think one of the key things in that is probably just not to get buried there. You know, I don't think they have to go through those first 28 and be 21-7 or 19-9. I think as long as they're not the reverse of that, you know, 7-21 or 9-19, that they should be fine. This is a team that, you know, a lot of new players. I think 11 new guys on the active roster. So it may be a team that in May is better than they are in April as they kind of, as I've used the word before, find their rhythm together. Yeah, I remember in 2012, Robin's first year, I think they were 17-23 through 40 games and didn't look very good. They beat Anaheim behind Gavin Floyd like 6-1, and all of a sudden things turned around. They ended up being in first place for 117 days that year. Now, it didn't finish like they wanted, but that's why it's, you know, even through a month, you're not completely sure what you have unless you get, you know, get out to a great start or get out to a horrible start. But it does enhance it a little bit playing so many teams in the division because, you know, it's a tough division. We talked about this before, Anthony, on the podcast. We're, you know, 85, 86 wins may win this division. So every win counts a little extra, I think, against division opponents.
A little extra. See what you did there, Merck.
I like, yeah, no pun intended.
Yeah, let's get the name right of your own podcast, by the way. Come on.
Sorry about that. Sorry.
All right. Joined, as always, by Rhett Bollinger. And Rhett is joining us from Detroit, where the Twins opened up their 2015 season, opened it on a bum note. But, boy, ended spring on a bum note, too, Rhett, with the Irvin Santana news. Just came way out of left field, you know, that late in camp especially. You really can catch a club off guard. I know the news was last week, but how people in that organization just kind of digested the whole thing. You have this guy, you think he's your number two starter, you're excited about him, and all of a sudden he's banged for half the season.
Yeah, it's a big blow for the Twins. I mean, this guy was their biggest, you know, free agent signing in history in terms of dollars, spending, you know, $55 million to sign him. And Friday morning, Terry Ryan was out in the practice field watching, and sure enough, he gets a call from Major League Baseball saying that Santana had tested positive for a steroid and it was going to be out for 80 games. Which is a big blow to the rotation, which is the team's biggest, you know, weak link, I guess you could say, last year. So he's kind of here to kind of solidify and fortify that. And for him to get that suspension right before the start of the season was definitely kind of a blow. Everything else kind of the spring was pretty positive. I mean, the rotation was pitching pretty well, actually. There was no real injuries at all. Nobody on the DL to open the season. But sure enough, right before the season, a big bombshell comes that, you know, no one really could see coming. So definitely not a good way to start off the year, and now it kind of had a ripple effect where we'll see Mike Telford in the rotation now, lefty Aaron Thompson in the bullpen, and we'll see what kind of effect it has in the bullpen in general, because we know that Santana, one of his biggest strengths was his ability to pitch deep into games. I think he's averaged close to 200 innings over the last 7 years, and now, you know, we're going to see how Telford does, but it could definitely take a toll on the bullpen as well.
But has there been any word on how Santana will approach this from, I mean, where will he work out, you know, what his program or timetable will be on that front as far as making sure that, you know, when the 80 games is up, that he is ready to meaningfully contribute to this club?
Well, Santana does live in Florida. I believe he lives in Clearwater with his wife and his kids. So I think the plan is for him to kind of take a little bit of time now in Clearwater, and I'm sure he'll continue working out, that kind of thing. But I think once he kind of gets a little bit ready to go, he'll start going over to the club's spring training complex in Fort Myers, because he has a lot of work out there, despite being suspended. And he does get, I believe it's either 16 days or 16 games. I keep hearing kind of back and forth the difference between the two, considering he's a pitcher. But he does get some time to be able to pitch in the minor leagues as well to get ready. His day he'd be back at the earliest would be July 4th, depending on if there's any rain outs or things like that. So he does have some time to kind of get ready for the season. But from what I've been told, he will spend the time there in Florida to get ready to get back.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Pelfrey had a kind of a crazy sequence of events down there at the end of camp. Obviously, was disappointed to not get a rotation spot and voiced that with you guys, with reporters, and then had a sit down with Terry Ryan right after that, and came out of that with a little funnier disposition about things. I'm sure. I'm guessing Mr. Ryan reminded him about how much the organization has stuck with him through some difficult days, but. Lo and behold, this rotation opportunity opens right back up a couple days later. So, you know, we know how baseball works, Rhett. Sometimes it's just those crazy situations that end up turning out so well. But what are your expectations for Pelfrey now that he is back in the starting rotation role?
Well, very curious to see how he does. I mean, the thing about it is, so far, since he came to the Twins, he really hasn't pitched very well. I mean, obviously, a couple years ago, on his first year here, he's coming off Tommy John surgery and got back in 11 months, which was probably too quick. He kind of struggled that first half of the season. Finally got it going in the second half, but they signed him to do a 2-year deal. And then sure enough, last year, he's going with you know, kind of numbness and tingling in his fingers and in his forearm. Sure enough, he had a nerve issue in there. He had to go in there and have surgery on his elbow and his forearm to fix that. He only made 5 starts last year as a result. And this year, finally, is what he says. You know, really in spring training, he looked healthy. His fastball was hitting as high as 95 miles per hour. We know he has a good stamp on his fastball to get ground balls. His ERA was in the ones. So he only had a good spring, and it was frustrating he didn't get that spot. But, you know, based on track records, it made sense to give it to Tommy Malone. Malone's only lefty in there. So Pelfrey kind of gets his wish now, and he keeps saying he's healthy and eager to prove what he can do, but it's kind of hard to predict. I mean, based on how much he struggled here the last 2 years, without the elbow problems, he hasn't had much of a track record in recent years at least, but he did have, you know, some good years there in New York. I think he's kind of eager to show the fans that he can do that, but I think right now Twins fans are a little bit leery, a little wary of how he's going to do this, because so far it hasn't really worked out so far in his, you know, 2+ years with the Twins.
Yeah, and the best thing for the Twins would be if some of those young kids in Triple. I mean, if Alex Meyer or Trevor May step up in Triple A and assert themselves as deserving of a rotation role. But opening day was a dud, Rhett. But J.R. Graham was kind of one bright spot there with two scoreless innings and a great story. Guy they pluck out of the Rule 5 draft and had rotator cuff issues. In the Braves organization and made it back from that, and the Braves left him unprotected, surprisingly so. Twins scoop him up, and lo and behold, he ends up on the opening day roster. So how does he fit in the bigger bullpen picture? And it sounds like he really opened some eyes in spring camp.
He definitely did. I mean, he's one of those guys, even leading up to the Rule 5 draft, you're right. A lot of scouts and people are talking about, that's an interesting guy to be out there. And I kept hearing the Twins are going to be taking him. And sure enough, they did, because he's a former top 100 prospect with the Braves, as a starter, converted to a relief last year, and pitched in Double-A, but never above that. So it's hard to exactly know what you're going to get in spring training, but he had a little bit, you know, a couple bad outings at the end there, but in general, showed really good velocity. He's probably the hardest throwing guy in that bullpen, and with some strikeouts, he played a good spring, and he's way on the roster, especially knowing as a Rule 5 guy, you keep him on the roster all year. And last, you know, in the opening day, he was really good. I mean, started off a little shaky. His first pitch almost hit Iglesias in the head, and then kind of settled down from there and got a couple guys on. But had a big double play from Kinsler. You got Miguel Cabrera pop out with that on third and two outs. Showed some moxie going after Cabrera. You'd think that maybe, especially being such a young guy, they might pitch around him a little bit. But he went right after Cabrera and got him out there. So now I was surprised, too, that they went to – he was the very first reliever they used all year. You know, you think a lot of times with teams with a Rule 5 guy, you kind of hide him. Maybe only use him in games where it's a blowout either way. That's kind of the way teams mostly go. But for him to be the very first reliever in a game that was, I believe at the time, only, you know, 4-0, it wasn't like it was a blowout of the game when he came in there in the seventh inning. And, yeah, he's definitely a bright spot, and I'm kind of curious to see how Mahler uses him. And the fact that they use him for two innings was kind of indicative of what they did all spring, too. They kept using their relievers for multiple innings, and I think that that's something they try to do a little bit more this year with all their relievers, except for maybe Perkins.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, the multi-inning standpoint. I think a lot of us would like to see more multi-inning relievers, especially with all the pace of play conversations going on. The Twins have they have the gold standard once upon a time for Rule 5 pickups with Johan Santana. I don't think anybody's expecting Graham to be at that level, but the Twins, as they're trying to piece together their pitching staff, they're an organization really in a good place to take advantage of this type of situation and to give a guy a chance to establish himself. So, and you mentioned Mulder, his bullpen use. I was surprised by his lineup against David Price on opening day with Arcia and Schaefer and Vargas all in there against the left-handed Price. Is that just a matter of a manager trying to build early confidence in his guys and you know, give them an opportunity to show they can handle lefties?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Mulder's comment was on the workout day on Sunday was, these are the guys that are regular, you know, in general, kind of bored of his different spots this spring. So he wanted to kind of roll him out there that first day. It kind of backfired, and you know, obviously the Price had a great game, and that you know, they were shut out. But at least he had kind of a confidence in, these are my guys. These are the guys that probably can play the most. But I was curious, you know, I mean, Eduardo Escobar had the best spring of anybody, and really his numbers against right-handers are really, really good if you look at him throughout his career. And even against Price, in a tiny sample size, I think he was still like 3-for-7 against him. That's some success against him. So I was surprised that they didn't try to find a way to get him in there. But at the same time, you know, with Vargas as a switch hitter, see if he could hit the ball a long way off Price. It made some sense. But I do think they're going to try to get Escobar in there a little bit more as we kind of go along here. And Robinson's an interesting one, too, because he's the platoon mate with Schaefer in center. But really, if you look at Robinson's career numbers, he really has kind of reverse platoon splits and has actually done better against righties and lefties. I'm kind of curious how they do that going forward, because that's kind of supposed to be the loose platoon in center field. But I'm curious to see how much they're going to use Robinson against lefties. He hasn't really hit that well against them in his career, and we know Schaefer hasn't at all. So kind of curious how that kind of works its way out as we go along.
Well, they got a lot of time to work it out, that's for sure. And I don't want to read too much into starting out 0-1. And we'll see how Paul Mulder and the Twins recover from that and also recover from the blow of losing Irvin Santana in an unexpected way. So I want to thank Rhett Bollinger for joining us to talk about all that, and thank you all for tuning in. It's been MLB.com Extras.